Yes. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you soon.
Your community connection, KBOO Portland. Woo-hoo.
Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church in Portland. This two-day event celebrates the ancient tradition of welcoming back loved ones who have passed on. There will be altar building, Muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, drink, and live musical performances. It's a benefit for Transiciones, a program at Mount Hood Community College that has helped Latino women for close to 20 years in reaching their academic and career goals. Again, that's a Muertos PDX Dia de los Muertos celebration on Friday, November 1st and Saturday, November 2nd from 4 to 9 p.m. at St. Andrew Catholic Church, 806 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Friday, KBOO invites you to come hang out with us in the KBOO studios for our first Friday Art Walk event and Give Guide kickoff party. Willamette Weekly's Give Guide handpicked 152 of Portland's most impactful nonprofits to help you do good this giving season, and it all starts November 1st. Making a donation on November 1st will give you a chance to win a $500 Pals shopping spree. If you're under 35, you get two chances to win. That's pretty awesome. Donate through our website at kboo.fm/give or in person at our kickoff party. We will be filling our studios with local art, awesome live music, cider, wine, and snacks. So come on out this Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. at the KBOO Studios. See you then.
Good evening. The time is 6:01, and you are listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Coming up next is First Voices Radio.
We choose the right to be who we are. We know the difference between the reality of freedom and the illusion of freedom. There's a way to live with Earth and a way not to live with Earth. We choose the way of Earth. It's about power.
Ihana Washtelo, na Ambetu Washtelo. Chante Washte na Pechu Zapilo, le unkipike he Washtelo, oyate hona umpi oholo oskatu wichoni. Greetings and good day and welcome, my relatives. I shake your hands with good feelings in my heart, and the whole world is a beautiful day. Today, without fear, we will tell your word and speak the truth. The nation shall live. It's good for all of us to be here and let the people hear your voice respectfully. Celebrate life. In addition to relativity, this is First Voices Radio. I send you greetings and strength from the east gate of Turtle Island, where the sun and the water touch the earth at once, and our website is firstvoicesindigenousradio.org, and I want to thank you for your generosity, as always, and for being here. You know who you are, and without you, we cannot continue. I'm your host, Teokas and Ghost Horse, all native hosted, all native produced, First Voices Radio, now in its 27th year of broadcasting. And First Voices Radio producer is Liz Hill. Welcome to the 181 FM stations that carry First Voices Radio. Thanks to those of you who monitor this program. A heartfelt thank you. Now let's count some coups. Our first guest, Tracy Osborne, is an associate professor in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona. And Tracy's research focuses on ecology of climate change, mitigation in tropical forests, particularly the role of indigenous peoples, and questions of climate justice. And Tracy founded and directs the Climate Alliance Mapping Project, which is a collaborative effort between academics, environmental NGOs, and indigenous organizations working for a socially just response to climate change through research, maps, and digital stories. Welcome to First Voices Radio, Tracy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Teokas, and thanks for the invitation.
You know, we tried to get you on about a month ago because it was right before the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and of course we were going to have, again, a person from the Sarayaku community or people, and luckily we have you, and it's very important to have this idea of the Kasak Sacha, which is a living forest climate project in Sarayaku, and that would be in Ecuador. I'd like to, you know, just talk to you about this proposal of the Quechua people of Sarayaku about the living with the natural world in a sustainable, harmonious way. And that's sort of a little elusive to Western thinkers in the sense that, you know, there's no parks, there's no, you know, there's no boundaries when it comes to native peoples. And what would there be when we think about this sustainable way in the Western way, but what would it be for a lot of people to understand the economic system as an ecological verb? I really like ecological verb or web, let's say it that way. So
yeah.
let's talk about this declaration that is, I think, an imminent thing because of the way the climate justice and climate is, you know, what's happening with the climate crisis, climate crash, basically.
Definitely.
You know, what's going on. And let's talk about the Kasak Sacha.
Definitely.
Okay.
No, I'd be happy to. I became aware of Kasak Sacha a few years ago when I met some of the leaders from Sarayaku who were presenting this proposal in the climate negotiations. They were at Paris, and but I met them at a number of the different international negotiations talking about this really important proposal. And I had the opportunity to be present at the launch of Kasak Sacha, which took place in Quito. It was about a 5-day event in Quito last year in July, where hundreds of members of Sarayaku came to sort of present this, kind of launch this proposal. And I became interested in it because of, I really see it as an important first of all, it's based on Sarayaku's sort of worldview or cosmovision. It's sort of their understanding of the relationship between humans, nature, and the protectors, the forest sort of beings, these beings that are both seen and unseen, but that protect the forest. And based on this understanding of forests as inhabited by living beings that are protectors of the forest, they have a whole set of sort of rules and norms by which they manage those forests. And those rules and norms, you know, result in highly biodiverse, carbon-rich forests. So because I've done so much work in the area of climate change mitigation and forests and have been able to see all of the ways in which they go wrong, you know, forests are clearly incredibly important as a climate change mitigation strategy, But so many of the ways in which we've been managing our forests for as a climate change strategy have gone wrong. And I'd be happy to sort of talk about some of the issues that I see with our current sort of more conventional strategies. So I really saw Kalzik Satcha as an important alternative. And as you mentioned, I was hoping to get some of the leaders to also be able to speak about Kalzik Satcha in their own words. I mean, obviously, I'm really learning from them. And I was able to sort of have a conversation with Daniel Santi, who's the coordinator of the Kalzik Satcha proposal. And I asked him, first of all, permission to be able to speak about it, but also if he wouldn't mind sort of sharing in his own words sort of what Kalzik Satcha means to Sarayaku. And so if you don't mind, I'd like to sort of just take a couple of minutes to sort of read this translation of what he sent me.
That would be excellent. Thank you.
So he writes, Kalzik Satcha means the living forest and is a proposal from the Kichwa people of Sarayaku that describes the relationship between humans, nature, and protective beings that include conservation and the daily practices of subsistence agriculture, fishing, and hunting. Although this proposal has been developed for more than a decade, since 2012, Sarayaku has begun to make it more visible as part of an effort to realize the rights of nature and indigenous peoples, as enshrined in the Ecuadorian Constitution of 2008. In July 2018, Sarayaku officially launched the Kalzik Satcha proposal with a multi-day event in Quito. There, Sarayaku declared its territory as a protected area free of extractive exploitation of oil, mining, timber, as well as market-based conservation mechanisms such as REDD+, which is an international initiative that stands for reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. I can talk more about that later if you'd like. Sarayaku also emphasized that Kalzik Satcha is a demand for the legal and political recognition of the existence of other beings, protectors of the forest, animals, and Pachamama, the earth herself. These protectors are living beings with consciousness and are constituted from all the beings of the forest, from the most infinitesimal to the greatest and supreme. It includes beings from the animal, vegetable, mineral, spiritual, and cosmic worlds in intercommunication with human beings, providing them with what is necessary to revitalize their psychological, physical, and spiritual aspects, thus restoring energy, life, and balance. This proposal is part of a longer struggle against extraction, particularly the extraction of oil, as well as a new framework and proposal that articulates Sarayaku's concrete life concepts and practices for harmonious living. It is more than just a tactic or strategy for confronting the exploitation and annihilation that comes from non-indigenous worlds. Kalzik Satcha constitutes, in short, a way of life and a way of making a sustainable world. And given that 80% of biodiversity is conserved by the indigenous peoples of the world, we ask the international community and conservation organizations to support and complement the task indigenous peoples have been carrying out for millennia, as well as their pragmatic proposals against climate change. So this is in the words of Daniel Santi, who's again the coordinator of the Kalzik Satcha proposal, and is really trying to sort of share this proposal as to the Western world as sort of their cosmovision and understanding of their relationship with forests. But also as, and this is some of the work that I've been doing with them more recently, really sort of thinking about how to articulate this as a climate change mitigation strategy. And I mean, is in terms of some of the work that I've been doing with them more recently in sort of how do we understand this, what are the climate benefits and of such a proposal, I think that there are three main elements. I mean, first of all, we know that forests are critically important as a climate change mitigation strategy, and that was, one of the main solutions that came out of the IPCC report on 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was a really important report of scientists, about over 130 scientists, that evaluated, you know, thousands of peer-reviewed articles recognized that, you know, climate change is an urgent, you know, issue where it's an ecological crisis, and that while there are a number of, you know, while there's definitely much reason for us to be concerned, and if we continue business as usual, we're looking at hitting, you know, the 1.5 degree mark by, you know, 2030. So that's like mm-hmm. now 11 years away.
And so,
you know, given that, what are some of the and they recognize that forests are a really critical piece of the climate strategy. And in terms of some of the key elements of Kazakh Svetcher, I just wanted to go back to that, is first of all, tree planting. They are, as part of their proposal, they want to create a border of flowering trees that they call the frontier of life or the trail of flowers. And this sort of, you know, border of flowering trees will represent something like a million trees that will be planted. As I mentioned, there's also a set of rules and norms for forest protection that also will be in place. Also really, I think, really critical, no exploitation of oil, you know, and so while a lot of the conventional strategies for climate change mitigation in forests, they don't necessarily consider oil underground or the carbon underground. I think, you know, maintaining, you know, oil underground and fossil fuels underground is really critical and also adds to the climate benefit.
Going back to the climate change mitigation in these forests and talking about tree planting, these flowering trees, thinking about the ideas that there are more trees in the United States than there were 100 years ago, that these trees are very young, and yet the old growth is about 2%, yet there's less wildlife in the United States. Now we apply that. If we plant young trees, new trees, what happens to the old trees there that support more life? Is there an imbalance in thinking there a little bit, Tracy?
Yeah, so I mean, definitely we're starting to see in places like the Northeast a return to forests. Or we do see, like you were mentioning, there are a lot more sort of newer growth forests and sort of, again, like sort of smaller size trees. You know, the types of forests that we find in places in indigenous managed forests like Sarayaku's forests are, you know, highly biodiverse. They're older growth trees, you know, older forests, high levels of biodiversity, and, you know, that means, you know, a much more stored carbon, much healthier ecosystems that are resilient to climate change impacts, and as I mentioned, you know, significant levels of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what's also really important to recognize is that, you know, the Amazon rainforest, which is where, you know, there are 9 countries within the Amazon, and these are some of the most highly biodiverse, you know, forests in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, the Amazon is the most biodiverse rainforest in the world. So in other words, forests are not equal, and so the specifically, the types of forest management that we want to support is the type of forest management that communities like Sarayaku are proposing.
Which makes that proposal of Daniel Santee and the Sarayaku people more important. About, you know, you talked about the payments. Well, you didn't, but payments for environmental services, carbon markets, and I want to talk about RED, the reducing emissions from deforestation and the forest degradation. And as you know, that Native people or Indigenous peoples have the smallest carbon footprint in the world, yet we experience the largest impact from the carbon footprints of other countries. Can you balance mm-hmm. that out for us?
Yes, no, definitely. That's a really important issue. So, you know, while industrialized countries and sort of wealthy communities are largely, I mean, the main drivers of climate change are the burning of fossil fuels and unsustainable land use, deforestation, and degradation. And as you mentioned, you know, it's sort of the industrialized world that's largely responsible historically for the climate change that that we're experiencing, and the most vulnerable are poor communities, the developing world, and particularly indigenous peoples. Mm-hmm. So some of the strategies that are being proposed are things like Red Plus, as you mentioned. And again, Red is a UN initiative that stands for reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. The Plus includes conservation, sustainable management of forests, and the enhancement of carbon stocks. So basically just, increasing carbon in an ecosystem. That enhancement of forest stocks can mean anything. It could mean it can mean just planting a lot of trees in a type of monocultural system. And actually a lot of the examples of carbon projects we've seen have been, much of it has been, not necessarily, it has been focused so much on the carbon and less on the other ecological, values and services of forests. The biodiversity, for example. So there are a number of key concerns associated with the conventional strategies of climate change mitigation in forests, such as RED. I think one of the main concerns, and many of the problems stem from the market orientation of many of these projects. When RED was first proposed, or when especially when RED is linked up with markets, and particularly these types of carbon offsets, which will allow entities, highly polluting entities that have, targets, and sort of requirements to reduce their emissions. These offsets allow large entities, large polluting entities, to be able to purchase these offsets from forests, for example, forest ecosystems, instead of making those changes at home. So this market mechanism allows, the idea was that, markets will provide a low-cost solution for high-emitting countries and, entities to meet their targets through these so-called low-cost, forest offsets. The truth is that in order to do that well, first of all, it would cost a lot more than the current carbon price. Mm. But beyond that, there's so many problems associated with forest carbon offsets. One is this issue of permanence. So you have to demonstrate that you're going to be able to maintain these forests over long periods of time. Even in tropical forests, we started to see, because of forest degradation, and sort of drought-like conditions, we've seen tropical forests burning. We also see changes in political regimes. So, for example, Bolsonaro, and the new president of Brazil, has put into place a certain set of policies that is very supportive of large-scale agriculture. Soy production. At the expense of conservation and forests. So if you have a change in the political regime, you could lose all of those, benefits, conservation benefits or benefits of, forest protection, in immediately if you have a change in political regime. But there are also problems in the sense, because the price of carbon, because it's a market mechanism that is seeking the lowest cost, possible solution, the price of carbon is low and volatile. So because it's so low, it actually never addresses the main drivers of deforestation, which are called forest risk commodities. These are soy production, beef, palm oil, and timber. So instead of really targeting the main drivers, carbon markets and carbon offsets tend to target smallholders. And indigenous peoples are among some of the groups that have been targeted. Their land use is then sort of forced to change in certain ways that in some cases can actually reduce carbon in the overall system. So those are some of the issues. These issues of permanence. The other issue that I didn't mention is this issue of leakage. So you might protect a forest in, let's just use Ecuador. You might protect a actually, let's use Mexico, where I've done a lot of my research. You might protect, you know, a certain area of forest in Mexico, and because of market demand, you know, those the forest might be deforested, or you know, and converted to palm oil production in a neighboring community or in another state in Mexico. So there's so many different ways in which these projects fail, from not addressing the main drivers to these issues of permanence, leakage. In some cases, these projects were going to happen anyway, so they're not necessarily additional. They tend to target smallholders and indigenous communities, even though they're not the main drivers, and kind of reshape their land use in ways that can actually have, you know, reduce the overall carbon benefits. Because if we look at a map of the most biodiverse and carbon-rich forests, those are indigenous managed forests. And so if we're changing their land use, that can actually cause some problems.
And this is, yeah, changing the land use means changing culture, tradition, even their language about disappearing species, animals, and even borders. Even that word of a border is kind of like a foreign concept, because you see a bird doesn't have a border. So I'm going
exactly
with this. So Tracy, I'm thinking about the, you know, the permanence you talked about. Is once there's a permanence like native people, there's obviously quality. But now the West is coming in with more of a temporary view about quantity. So it's the quantity you're getting out of the trees, and yet mm-hmm. that allows no permanence. And is that thinking, I mean, of course, the answer could be yes, that thinking temporarily about something which will lead to the real deforestation in people's minds as it is applied to a forest, a living forest, that means there are less species, because it's just not the trees mm-hmm. keeping the animals alive, it's the animals keeping the forest alive. And so mm-hmm. it's cyclical in this thing. And then I'll go back down to the indigenous folks who are actually mm-hmm. helping that forest stay alive. And that's the impulse I think I want to get out to the people, that any plan coming from Native people who have lived, you know, time immemorial, like the Sarayaku people, have this, they don't have a term for sustainable development, because they've been sustaining community all along. Mm-hmm. It's only the West coming in with this term sustainable development, which doesn't make sense. Can you unravel that for us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's you know, some of the issues that we see with some of the conventional climate change projects, in that it's so focused on these on the unit of carbon that it creates certain it creates forests that tend to have lower levels of biodiversity, and also to the extent to which we might be concerned about you know, the longevity and the resilience of those forests that are, you know, are less diverse. Whereas, like, as you've mentioned, you know, indigenous, and just sort of based on my experience working with Sarayaku, you know, they have a much more holistic understanding of sort of forest health, and because it's part of their relationship with those forests, and they see it as, you know, as in, like I was mentioning, like inhabited by living beings that are protectors of those forests, and they have a relationship that is an integrated and sort of ongoing relationship that is not just about a particular unit, but is a sort of a more holistic understanding that produces highly, you know, sort of biodiverse environments. And as you mentioned, I mean, it's not that they're doing this for for climate. I mean, there happen to be significant climate benefits, or for the biodiversity. But as you mentioned, it's, you know, part of their, you know, historically they have been maintaining these forests. It's part of their lives and livelihoods. But it's also a very deep sort of spiritual relationship that is connected to culture. And that's one of the really important, so many indigenous communities that I'm aware are losing their language. And so I think I know that Sarah Yaku and a number of the indigenous communities that I've been meeting with in the Amazon, language and culture are deeply important, and they want to make sure that that's maintained through generations and for the youth to maintain that language. But I do think that based on when you look at sort of the types of proposals that Sarah Yaku is putting forth compared to these sort of more traditional projects, it is significantly more holistic, that sort of allows you to have a lot more confidence in sort of the permanence of those types of systems. It's not based on a change in political regime, right? I mean, it's not about, oh, well, if we have a government that's going to change their mind, like Bolsonaro, on the value that they place on forests, that we could lose all of those forests. Also, you know, certain types of ecosystems and forest projects that are heavily based on and focused on carbon might be less resilient to fire. Whereas indigenous communities, if, you know, from the ones that I've been working with, if you give them the support that they need for maintaining their culture, their ongoing forest practices, that, you know, for generations have been protecting those forests, and indigenous peoples have been risking their lives, putting their lives on the line to be able to protect those forests. And, you know, if we recognize that, you know, something like, you know, while, you know, the world, the indigenous peoples make up something like 5% of the total population, they're managing or they're holding land tenure to something like 25% of the world's, you know, terrestrial ecosystem. And so they're controlling, or they're holding about and managing about 25% of the, you know, the above ground carbon in forests and other ecosystems. So very few people are making a huge difference when it comes to forest protection, forest resilience, and carbon storage and biodiversity. So it's a very different, this, and that's why the worldview is critically important. It's a worldview that's not just focused on the economics, on the financial, or even just sort of these ecological units. It's focused more holistically on these ecosystems, particularly as a relationship between you know, people and their environment.
We're talking,
and one that they want to sustain for more than seven generations.
I do understand that so well. We're speaking with Tracy Osborne, a professor of University of Arizona in the School of Geography and Development, and expertise in climate change mitigation in forests and roles of the role of indigenous peoples. And Tracy, we talked on the way back from last summer from a conference somewhere in out there in Southwest Colorado, and I got very interested in this Kasak Sacha proposal. And now it's a year going on now, and I'm hearing weighing the Kasak Sacha with other proposals that are coming out of the UN, you know, climate change mitigation from that end, where they measure, weigh, and even provide the cost or financial. Either it's going to lack or gain or whatever, but then they make a moral decision. That's what I'm saying. With the indigenous folks in Sarah Yaku, it's that there is no moral decision. It's the thing you have to do to support life. So when they talk about holistic, where's the practicality within that holistic view for the Western thinkers, so to speak, and institutions? Are they going to rationalize why they can't do it holistically? Because for me, the holistic is where you know specifically the details of why it goes to a bigger picture, because they're looking at the whole forest, not just one tree.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. No, definitely. So, I mean, you know, Kasak Sacha is one element of Sarah Yaku's life plan. So life plans are sort of this, it's this indigenous vision for development within the community. So it's, you know, and Sarah Yaku, they've created their own life plan, and so they have a really good sense of what they would, you know, how they would like to further develop their community in terms of communication, transportation, education, kind of areas of health. And Kasak Sacha is one element of this broader life plan. Mm-hmm. I think the the life plan, you know, so in terms of practicalities, I think the life plans are key. And I think they're also really important to be as, you know, as first of all, an alternative to the type of development that's coming out of the state, you know, out of government. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important because there are indigenous communities that, I mean, there are needs, right? There are economic and sort of material needs that require support, like financial support. And if, as part of this broader climate change, you know, strategy, if life plans could also be supported, indigenous life plans could also be supported, that would better ensure that indigenous peoples would not give their consent to extractive industries or other, you know, destructive forms of development. And I mean, and you know, even without that support, indigenous peoples are certainly holding the line against the encroachment of and the movement of deforestation into their territories and, you know, into highly biodiverse areas. But in terms of kind of the practical, like what are the nuts and bolts of, you know what are the nuts and bolts of these types of proposals? You know, we mentioned the tree planting, and again, this is not just sort of reforestation. These are kind of a symbolic sort of frontier of flowering trees, mm-hmm. That will be, you know, sort of in that will be planted in kind of a circular area at around the border of Sarayaku that sort of represents this is a living forest. And again, like really sort of thinking about what are the rules and norms. And again, like these rules and norms by which they manage their forests for agriculture, for hunting, for fishing, for also sustainable forest management, they already exist. You know, so that's another sort of practical, you know, element. And again, Sarayaku has for decades have been protecting their forests against oil and timber extraction. And part of Kauzuk Sacha is a declaration that these areas that are under the designation of Kauzuk Sacha are declared zones that are free from oil, mineral, and timber extraction. So that's also critically important, and that's very a practical kind of outcome of Kauzuk Sacha that has a climate benefit that we also don't see in your more conventional climate forest projects.
Well, Tracy,
So I just wanted to mention that, you know, that Sarayaku has been very clear and expressed concern about carbon markets for all of the reasons that I mentioned, but also, you know, the commodification of nature is incompatible with Kauzuk Sacha, you know, which recognizes the value of forests that go beyond the financial. Mm. It recognizes the you know, the social, the cultural, like you mentioned, like the sacred value of nature. And so while they're very much concerned about markets and the offset, you know, they don't want their management of forests to allow a large oil company in California, for example, to continue to emit, and all of the, you know, the social implications, the environmental justice implications for the nearby communities. However, support for Kauzuk Sacha through a fund for indigenous forest protection and management could provide the necessary support to realize indigenous life plans, like Sarayaku's life plan, and also realize Kauzuk Sacha and make that a robust, you know, it already exists, but to really support Sarayaku in the continuation of forest management, and also support for their life plans, the type of development that they'd like to see for their community.
Well, great. Tracy Osborne, thank you so much for being here. Lots of information, lots to know about and you know, find out about here in the United States as well as in Brazil. Thank you for your work, and we'll stay tuned. And thank you for directing that Climate Alliance mapping project that's happening now. Please stay tuned. I want to make sure that we have this right. Tracy is a Cossack. Sacha is kawsakasacha.org.
That's correct.
.org as a website. Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Diokasen.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
All right, this is First Voices Radio. My name is Teokasen Ghost Horse. We have a few minutes left, and I wanted to squeeze this part in. It's really about five women who went to Jamaica this past month, last few weeks ago. And it's surprising how people don't know what's going on here within the contiguous states up in Alaska as well as Hawaii. In this segment of First Voices Radio, you will be hearing the personal stories of struggle from five Indigenous women at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Jamaica. And I thought better just go right into that and let you know that it's self-explanatory. So please, those of you who are listening, listen up a little deeper.
Good morning, distinguished members of the Commission, Secretariat, and representatives of the United States government. My name is Shauna Howard. I'm with the University of Arizona Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program. Thank you for meeting with us today. We requested this hearing along with the Water Protectors Legal Collective and over 70 Indigenous and environmental organizations. The Water Protector Legal Collective has provided legal defense to the Indigenous-led resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline at the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in North Dakota. I am here today supporting this delegation of Indigenous women who are at the forefront of resistance to pipelines, energy projects, and militarization of Indigenous lands. They have traveled here to share their personal stories and are urgently seeking help from the international community as we all face the imminent threat of climate change caused by the fossil fuel industry. Standing Rock is an emblematic case of Indigenous resistance to extractive industry that drew attention from around the world as water protectors met on the banks of the Missouri River in peaceful assembly and in what was the largest gathering of Indigenous peoples in the United States in 100 years. Standing Rock is merely one example of how the United States government works with industry to approve energy projects carried out without the meaningful participation or consent of Indigenous nations. Indigenous peoples are left with no choice but to peacefully protest and then are criminalized for their efforts to defend their lands and resources. Since Standing Rock, there has been an increasing trend by state legislatures to criminalize Indigenous peoples and their allies who voice opposition to pipelines and other so-called critical infrastructure projects. The information provided today builds on a 2016 request for precautionary measures filed by the Standing Rock, Cheyenne River, and Yankton Sioux tribes, and past commission reports on Indigenous peoples and extractive activities and the criminalization of human rights defenders. In addition, the United Nations has reported on the situation at Standing Rock through the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Expert Mechanism, and the Permanent Forum. We encourage the United States to comply with its obligations under the U.S. Constitution, the American Declarations on both the rights and duties of man and the rights of Indigenous peoples, specifically the rights of all citizens to free expression, peaceful assembly, judicial protection, and equality before the law, and the rights of Indigenous peoples to self-determination and rights to culture, religion, and property, including rights and interests in traditional territories and sacred areas designated as public lands. We call upon the Commission to follow up on the requests to the United States issued by the UN Special Rapporteur to develop and provide anti-oppression and anti-racism training to law enforcement agents and to mandate the Department of Justice to open an investigation into the excessive use of force and militarized response to the water protectors at Standing Rock. We also have a number of other recommendations that we will share with the Commission in a follow-up written report. Thank you.
I'm from the Tohonatam, the desert people of the southwest Turtle Island, now called Arizona, United States, and Chuigusk, Sonora, Mexico. I am Ophelia Rivas. I acknowledge this island's ancestors, the Arawak people. Today I'm testifying as a direct witness of the and a descendant of over 500 years of brutal genocidal policies against indigenous people by the United States government. In 1848, the Treaty of Guadalupe, Hidalgo, and in 1853, the Gadsden Purchase divided my original homelands into two countries, the United States and Mexico, without any discussion and agreement with the Tohono'odham. Today, we exist on one-tenth of our original lands in the United States, and our homelands in Mexico have been stolen and sold by the state government and have been taken over by drug cartels, displacing and forcing people into exile. With the most recent impact after 9/11 was the heavily militarization of our homelands by the United States Department of Homeland Security. The racist U.S. policies such as the Patriot Act and inhumane immigration policies greatly affect the Tohono'odham, each Tohono'odham household. Today, people are attacked with dogs. They have been invaded, have home invasions. They're detained in their homes, within their homes, with their children. People are attacked on the roads by armed military, often forced off the road and detained and without cause. The United States Department of Homeland Security criminalized the Tohono'odham. I have witnessed elders, 80 years old, forced to kneel with their arms behind their heads on the roadside for not speaking English or Spanish because they only speak their own language and do not understand the demands to provide citizenship, proof of citizenship on their own homelands. The United States Manifest Destiny legacy of genocidal policies of superiority and destined to subjugate and outright wipe out the so-called inferior races prevails as the world witnessed the attack on water protectors at Standing Rock. Thank you for listening at this time, and it has been difficult to reduce the statement with time allowed. I pray that all impacted animals and plants and living beings will be fully recognized and protected. Thank you.
Tatia, this is Yuzi Panka of the my state bank, Oklahoma. Who are he tamajik there at Dinke Ganka D Tate Ati? Good morning to you. I'm Yuzi. My colonized name is Casey Camp Hornick. I'm from the occupied territory of Oklahoma, or Indian Territory. I want to say thank you for listening to the honored commissioners. Also want to say thank you to the ancestors of the Arawak people and to the people of Jamaica. I'm a member of the Ponca Nation of Oklahoma. I serve as an elected council member. I'm also the hereditary drum keeper for the Women's Society. The Ponca had their traditional land stolen by the federal government under the Treaty of 1868. And at that time, we were forcibly removed to Oklahoma, which was Indian Territory at that time. There were three indigenous tribes there. Now there are 39 federally recognized tribes. My tribe was one of those that walked a trail of tears. My grandfather was 8 years old at that time when he walked 670 miles with my grandparents and great-grandparents. One in three died on that trip. Another one in three died after our forced removal down there. We were from the Missouri River, where the Niobrara and Nishude, or the Missouri River, came together. We now live in an area that is entirely impacted by the extractive industry, particularly at this time, Phillips 66 refinery and tank batteries were impacted by fracking. All of the water is being poisoned. All of the water is being extracted as well. We had 10,000 earthquakes in the last 5 years that are man-made earthquakes that are impacting our water sources. All of the four legs, fins, wings, under the grounds, all of those things are being impacted. You can't grow organic food within an 8-mile radius of where we live because of the extractive industry polluting us so bad. Virtually every single family has many, many cancer problems autoimmune problems, children being born with cancer, many children not making it to birth. So we live under a policy of environmental genocide, with the policies of the United States government continuing to deregulate and allow more pollution to happen, including carbon trading, which is poisoning the air even more. And commodifying all of the sacred to us is a crime. We have passed our own statute called the Rights of Nature that we believe will give us some stature in the courts, and we will be taking people into the Ponca courts. When Standing Rock happened, my sons were up there. We were there as a result of prayer. When my sons called me and told me about a meeting of the tribal historic preservation officers, I went up there. And that was on October 27th of 2016. When I arrived at this meeting, it was to protect all the things downstream where my people's traditional lands and graveyards were. All of the tribes that were gathered there heard about a heavy militarized police force that was descending on the treaty camp that was just north of the original camp, and it was there to protect the Missouri River at that time, to keep the pipeline from going through that had not been allowed through a white area just north of that, but was being allowed. Standing Rock were our allies. We gave them our allyship in form of resolution. When we arrived there and the police began to come, there were helicopters, planes, drones, armed personnel vehicles with LRAD, sound cannons, percussion grenades, pepper spray, hundreds of militarized, riot-geared police who descended on us and began to brutalize us, knocking us to the ground. As we stood in prayer, hundreds of unarmed women, men, and children. They zip-tied us. They put us on the ground. They hauled us in buses to the basement of Morton County Jail, where they imprisoned us in dog cages after they wrote numbers on our arms, like the Jews going to the gas chambers. That was my number, number 138. There was 142 of us arrested that day. Children in there having seizures because they were untreated diabetics. We were kept in dog cages on the bare cement floor. This is only one sign of things that have happened to us. And since I came back, House Bill 1138 was passed in Oklahoma to further criminalize us. Thank you.
Yat Eabin, Leola Cowboy Anisha, Dine Nishla. I am here today to serve as a voice for the No Dapple political prisoners because they are imprisoned and I consider each family. I come in a good way, and I am honored to be the wife of No Dapple political prisoner Little Feather. These five Indigenous people encountered the most serious charges. They are Red Fawn Fallis, Michael Little Feather Hudon, Dion Ortiz, Michael Radler Marcus, and James Angry Bird White. Each has endured federal indictments. The men were facing 15 years in prison and one woman life. Each faced with no choice but to accept non-cooperating plea agreements, and as a result of the denial of discovery rights, denial of change of venue, despite surveys showing the local jury pool was substantially biased by the concerted corporate propaganda campaign. One person has received 2 years supervised release and another 16 months in prison. The remaining three are currently in federal prisons across the United States, far from their families and communities, currently serving 36 to 57 months. I have a statement, and I'll read it from Red Fawn. I was at the Ocheti Shikoan camp to defend the water, the land, and the treaties. I was also there to honor the memory and life work of my mother, Troy Lynn Star Yellowwood, who passed to the spirit world. There, I found a place where I belonged. I worked with elders and youth. I was trained as a medic for the people. During my time there, I was arrested 3 times. The first was in August of 2016, along a public right-of-way. There were a small group of us exercising our free speech rights against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Again, in September 2016, I was arrested along with 20 other people. We were praying and prayer ties to a fence, not crossing any fences. As we were leaving, Morton County Sheriff's deputies began arresting us for praying peacefully on our treaty homelands. And then October 2016, I was tackled from behind and brutally arrested without probable cause and accused of having a gun. The only gun that was brought into camp was by Heath Harmon, an FBI informant. He started a dishonest relationship with me. We understand the importance of our reciprocal relationship with water and all the life it supports. Thank you. Water is life.
Honorable Commissioners, hello, my name is Michelle Cook. I'm an enrolled member of the Navajo Nation, one of 500 indigenous people still living in the United States. The state party will tell you that the U.S. protects indigenous peoples. They will tell you they support the U.N. Declaration. They will talk to you about a consultation policy and compliance with human rights. What they won't tell you is how those rights are abrogated, extinguished, and divested for private profit for oil companies like ETP and TransCanada. I am here to tell you the Indian side of what we learned during and after the phenomenon of Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline. In the case of the Dakota Access Pipeline, during the 7 months from September 2016 to February 2017, at least 76 law enforcement agencies, 35 federal agencies, and private security firms hired by the oil company were present at some time. Over the 7 months, law enforcement and prosecutors aggressively charged 841 water protectors exercising their constitutional rights and peaceful assembly. Many of these arrested were detained under abusive conditions, subjected to unnecessary strip searches, and jailed hours away from camps in humiliating conditions. Local authorities prosecuted these criminal charges despite the fact that there was no probable cause to support a vast majority of the arrests and no evidence to prove the charges. Water Protector Legal Collective is currently pursuing a class action lawsuit regarding the injuries that occurred on November 20th. Post-Standing Rock, oil and gas interests are pushing to criminalize protests against their fossil fuel projects by engineering bills purported to protect against critical infrastructure sabotage. To date, there are 95 anti-protest bills that have been proposed. 35 states, including North Dakota, 14 have passed, 24 are pending, 55 have been expired and defeated, and 28 are currently pending in state legislators. In Texas, for example, House Bill 3557 would make some forms of protest a second-degree felony on par with second-degree murder. In South Dakota, Riot Boosting Act has created a fund specifically dedicated to going after groups out of the state. These bills are a direct response to Standing Rock, and we encourage the commission to look at these bills and to follow the recommendation of the special rapporteur. Thank you.
And that was Shauna Howard, University of Arizona's Indigenous Peoples Law and Policy Program, who introduced Ophelia Rivas and a Tohono O'odham Nation of Arizona, Mexico. Casey Camp Hornick from the Ponca Nation of Oklahoma and a tribal council member. Laloya Cowboy, a Dene or Navajo and wife of imprisoned Little Feather. And also Michelle Cook, the Dene lawyer, which you heard last. I'd like to thank you for joining us here on First Voices Radio as we listen to these five indigenous women at the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in Jamaica. And, of course, that had testimony, a rebuke by the government to represent the United States in saying that this wasn't what the indigenous people basically described. And I know it's different. So I'd like to thank you. Oshimala ye oyate wani wachichuelo. I do this so that you may live, that all life may live. And that means all life, not just humans. So thank you again. We'll see you next time.
It's a long road. Oh. Every day I wake up and turn my phone on. I read the news of the day just as it's coming down. I do my best not to let it get me down. I try to keep my head up, but this is Babylon. This world's in crisis, we try to fight it. This changing climate, with scientists and with politicians divided by it. So many ways we could solve it, but they will never sign it. This mountain's tumbling down, but still we try to climb it. It's in the Torah, Quran, and in the Bible. Love is the message, but somehow we turn to rivals. It's come to people always picking up their rifles. Another school getting shot up, homicidal. Some people trying to look fly, some people trying to get high. Some people losing their mind, some people trying to get by. And when you look in my eyes, you'll see the sign of the times. We all looking for the same thing. But what if this
song... KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd from 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge in Portland. Project Northwest and Arcadia Beats host Hip Hop Halloween, featuring performers Figure 8 AF, Contra Killas, and Dub Dynamic, a costume contest, tarot readings, and more. Project Northwest is a pro-black, pro-women, pro-queer online zine and showcase for hip hop and R&B artists in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's Hip Hop Halloween on Saturday, November 2nd. From 9 p.m. to midnight at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Outside the Frame trains homeless and marginalized youth to be directors of their own films and lives. Their annual gala showcases a collection of short films by and about invisible communities in plain sight, young Honduran trans women who walk to Oregon, houseless folks forced to migrate in their hometown, and much more. Again, that's Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening.